The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Well now, what parallel universe is this? England 4, Ukraine 0, keeping the ball, scoring goals at will, in total control. Where was the stress? Where was the agony? Where was the Müller moment? Resting players with half an hour to go. Olays for the last 10 minutes. Ukraine weren't up to much, but that was really quite pleasurable. Harry Kane appears not to have lost it. Raheem Sterling imperious. Jadon Sancho's flashes of brilliance in midfield that controlled everything. Luke Shaw's superb. Jordan Henderson's first goal for his country. How will this go wrong? Did we use up all our goals? Are we complacent? Does it matter that the semi-final is on ITV? Will the Danes, the Spanish or the Italians break our hearts? Or will it come home? You've sent in many questions, mainly how is Barry? We'll ask them, look ahead to the semis. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. First off, let's talk to Jacob Steinberg, who's in Rome. How was that, Jacob?
You would have to describe it as comprehensive. You can probably hear behind me the England fans who are here. I'm just looking down there at the fans who are saluting the players there. Great connection with the supporters. Really good atmosphere tonight at the Stadio Olimpico. Just a feeling, I think, connection between the team and the fans that obviously has built up so much under Southgate. It never really felt tonight like England were ever going to lose. I mean, they came out very, very composed, very confident, I thought, immediately dominating the ball. And unlike some of the other games that we've seen from them so far at the tournament, they got that early goal straight away. Clearly, Harry Kane's goal against Germany on Tuesday in the last 16 has done something for him. It looked much more confident, much sharper tonight. I thought a little bit, England a little bit as it in the first half, got a little bit nervy at times. There was that chance for Yaremchuk. At times they were getting down the flanks a little bit, and towards the end of the first half it did feel, there was a bit of a feeling in the press box that Ukraine may well equalise. That didn't happen, and there was a bit of maybe a bit more intensity at the start of the second half as well. Turned it on, and then that was it basically. And they were never coming back from that Maguire goal, which is big moment as well for Southgate, because he's been complaining about the set pieces. I'm sure that Luke Shaw will be pleased to have come up with two assists the day after Jose Mourinho arrived in Rome.
What's it like to be in a stadium where England are passing the ball around and the crowd are olaying, and it's all just calm, and there's no jeopardy?
Odd, but I mean, they weren't up against a great side tonight. I think they're probably a little bit fortunate that Spain went on this side of the draw. That could have been the semi-final. I don't think it would have been 4-0 against Spain. Ukraine have done well to get this far, but I think it's going to be much harder against Denmark on Wednesday. I find that a much harder game to call. I think England will start as favourites, but Denmark are one of the most exciting teams I've watched in the tournament, and obviously they've got this, the momentum as well from what happened before. There's a bit of a narrative there. So in England as well, they didn't score against them in the Nations League. There were two difficult games, and Denmark won at Wembley. So that's a tight one to call.
You said the atmosphere was great. Apparently, there were, I don't know how many England fans. It felt like there were more England fans in Rome than we expected there to be.
Yeah, we were walking up to the stadium, and there are some guys in England shirts walking behind us. And we thought, how on earth have they got here? And then they started talking in Italian accents. So maybe just everybody here in Rome has just decided to support England. Maybe that's what's happened. I'm not sure how there are so many people here. There are quite a few Ukraine fans as well. They made a lot of noise to the end. They enjoyed themselves and everything.
Jacob, we'll let you get on with all the work you've got to do. Thanks for coming on.
Cheers.
Jacob Steinberg there at the Stadio Olimpico. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you very much. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, hello.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm feeling good.
Yeah, absolutely. A question. I tweeted out for questions, and Barry Glendenning got in touch and said, can I be excused? Hi, Barry.
And apparently the answer was no. So here I am.
Here you are.
He's sitting in the dark, though. That's how much he can't handle it. He's just sitting with one beam of light on his face.
BNE Shrimper says, I really like Barry and totally understand his stance on the England team. That's part of being a football fan. However, I am really looking forward to his pain on the podcast. Mark sent me a gif of saying, Barry tonight, and it was of a panda in an armchair just covering his eyes. DN35 said, would Barry prefer to be on a tube right now in Munich with a dodgy stomach or on this podcast? How are you, Barry?
I'm fine, Max. It's a hugely impressive win for England, and I'm taking what positives I can out of it. They used up far too many goals. Luke Shaw played a blinder on Jose Mourinho's new pitch. Assorted Tory MPs and Brexiteers didn't get to see the game because they're boycotting the England team for taking a knee. Our Prime Minister has shown himself up again by posing in a very tatty suit on a massive England flag for a publicity shot. Jordan Henderson scored a goal. We like Hendo, his first goal for England. I'm a big fan of his. And hopefully someone will realise how upset I am by this result. You can take a screen grab of my tears. Some weirdo in Wales will hopefully set up a Just Giving page and get idiots to donate $25,000 to me to help ease my pain.
Justin says, is England winning comfortably at a tournament the weird experience in football? Flo, I found it really odd that last 25 minutes. You know, just, well, I mean, I was obviously working on the script for the pod, but, you know, thinking about things to do. Just sort of like, we've won this game.
Yeah, I think for me, the weirdest thing was like, I really needed a wee and I could go for a wee. Like, it wasn't, I didn't feel like I was going to miss anything by going for a wee. Whereas normally you'd be like, I cannot go for a wee because anything could happen during that time. But yeah, I mean, I have believed and felt confident throughout most of this tournament. But tonight I thought it was going to be like 2-0 and a bit nervy. I didn't think that it was going to go like that. And there were pockets, there were moments where, you know, Ukraine had opportunities, but England were just clinical and they have been really clinical throughout the tournament, and it is so good to see.
Wilson, you've spoken a lot about how tournament football is simplistic compared to club football and how you have to, you know, you don't have time with the players. But I got a real sense watching that game, and Ukraine were not great. I think we do have to point that out. And I think they've only won one game in normal time in this competition. Is that right? Against North Macedonia. But England looks so well coached. Like, they're pressed. They press together. They look like a sort of tactically astute football team.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what you hope happens. That I think inevitably, when you start a tournament, there are players who've come from all over the place. You're never going to have that cohesion, that unity, particularly when so many players have been involved in the two European finals and so couldn't even play in those final two friendlies. And what you hope is that the work you've put in previously is a foundation, and that as you go through the tournament, you get more togetherness and you get more of a sense of mutual understanding. And the teams that win tournaments tend to build in that way. And yeah, you have to take into account it was a Ukraine side who, especially as soon as the second goal went in, their heads, yeah, they were gone. That was it. They were finished. And I think you did see the fatigue there of the Sweden game when they actually played well. I mean, we shouldn't sort of underestimate Ukraine. They were not a terrible side, but yeah, I think you could see that particularly in the first half, I thought the press was really encouraging and really good. And that's, you've got to give Southgate credit for that.
Barry, did someone just walk past your house singing "Football's Coming Home"? I wonder if you were going to get the Super Soaker out.
I think it was my flat. Just down on the riverside there was a group of four lads walk past.
Yeah, I'm at the front of my house. There's a lot of football coming homing out the back, but not on this side.
Barry what? Soundproofed it, so you can't get any of that coming through. Yeah, no, I thought it was interesting in the first half as well how England kind of let Ukraine have a fair amount of the ball as well. They weren't too worried about what they were going to do with it. And also, kind of adding to what Jonathan said, after that second England goal, it felt like Ukraine kind of gave up on defending set pieces. They sort of, I mean, Henderson's header, they just let him stroll through. They were like, can't really be arsed now. It's kind of over. Just might as well let him have it. But yeah, it was kind of just interesting how the game escalated that quickly. It probably sounds rude to say Ukraine gave up, but it did kind of feel like they gave up.
I think, again, having been at a Sweden game, what Ukraine did really well was the quick switches of play from wing-back to wing-back and the link-up on the right-hand side between Yarmolenko and the right wing-back, Karasayev. And they didn't do that at all tonight. Now, presumably they were trying. I know they switched to 4-3-3 after, I don't know, what, 35 minutes or whatever. But England stopped them doing that. And that's a sign of good scouting, good research, and then formulating a plan, putting it into effect, and it working. So, in the same way, it's very easy to sort of to get overexcited by England. It's also very easy to be very dismissive when England win easily. Yes, England are better than Ukraine. Yes, they should beat Ukraine. But the way they did it was very impressive, and they stopped Ukraine doing the thing they were very good at on Tuesday.
Yeah, and in the Sweden Ukraine game, Zinchenko was in a more comfortable position for himself. He played at fullback, whereas today he was far more central, playing in central midfield again, which is what Ukraine have been trying to do. But it didn't quite work, and maybe it could have been a different story if he was playing out wide, and perhaps he would have had more on the ball and they would have been able to use that as more of an outlet. But yeah, it felt like they were lacking a lot of options, and they were trying to make the most of England mistakes, of which there were a couple, but they just couldn't capitalise on them.
Barry, Raheem Sterling is having some tournament, isn't he?
He's fantastic. I'm not sure. I can't even remember what I was expecting from him, or if I thought he'd even play before the start of the tournament. I certainly don't think I was among the quite fervent group who thought he shouldn't be picked. But he's been a... I was going to say he's been a revelation, but he hasn't been a revelation. We know how good he can be. And I suppose he's quite fresh insofar as he didn't play a huge amount for Man City during the season. He's coming to this tournament with his dander up, probably has a point to prove against his many naysayers. And I'm delighted to see him do that. But it's not a surprise to see how good he is, because we've seen it before. But he did have a patchy spell of form, and for reasons that I suppose draw your own conclusions, he tends to get hammered more than other players when they're out of form.
I think what's interesting, Wilson, is Foden was Foden is ahead of Sterling at Manchester City, and Sterling is ahead of Foden at England. And that doesn't have to be wrong on either case, does it?
No, because I think this is a thing that it's not that you have a list of all the footballers in the world and they're all ranked in order and that's coherent. It depends entirely on circumstance. And what England need is a player who can run beyond Harry Kane. And Sterling's really good at doing that. And I think the way that Sancho played and Saka in the previous game, previous two games, running beyond Kane, helped England look more dangerous as an attacking force. The way City play is slightly different. The job Foden does, coming in off the left, helping to link the midfield to the forward line. It's a different job with different players and a different system. So, of course, the person who's better doing that isn't necessarily the same.
You mentioned Sancho there. Flo, what did you make of his performance?
I thought he was okay. I didn't think he was terrible, and I didn't think he was incredible. I think he had a few good runs where he took out a few players and went past a few players. But it is very obvious, and this is what people have been saying for a long time about Sancho, how little he does defend and how that affects other people and how that affects the team. So from watching him play tonight, I do understand a little bit more why Southgate has left him out and why it's kind of worked without him. It's not in a sense that I think he didn't make the most of an opportunity. I don't think this England side as it is the best for Jadon Sancho and the way he wants to play. And I think maybe in a different sort of England team, he probably could flourish. But right now, I don't think it quite works. And it definitely didn't work when him and Sterling switched sides, because Sterling is so much more impactful on the left. And when they briefly switched sides in the second half, that just kind of wasted 15, 20 minutes, really.
I thought he was better than that, Sancho. I'm sort of blind.
No, I did as well. I thought he was really good.
If you look at when he's played well, it's always been when he's had a very attacking fullback playing up close to him, going outside him so he can come inside. And that's true whether he plays on the right or the left. He's had success. Kyle Walker wasn't doing that. And that's not an issue with Kyle Walker. It's that Southgate doesn't want his fullbacks to be particularly attacking or to be discerning in how they attack. But I thought it was also significant that if you're nitpicking, if you're looking for things that England could improve on that performance, you'd say there were two moments in the first half when Walker made mistakes that could have cost England. And I wonder if that was partly because he felt a bit exposed by Sancho not giving him the cover that, say, Saka did.
Can I ask Jonathan if you were surprised by how little Ukraine had to offer? Because apart from, a 10-minute spell just before half-time, they were pretty feeble.
Was I surprised? I mean, the thing is, there's such a difference between how Ukraine played against Austria and how they played against Sweden. It's very hard to know which the real Ukraine is. So, yeah, I was actually really impressed by them against Sweden. Really impressed by them, and yet they could easily have lost that game if either of the Forsberg chances at the woodwork had gone in. But yeah, I thought they played well then. I could see that the way they were switching play from wing to wing, that because Sweden played that very blockish 4-4-2, I could see that really troubled Sweden. And I have to say, when I saw the England lineup, the fact that it was a back four, not matching up the same shape as Ukraine, I was a little bit worried. I thought that was demanding and held the ball very well. But they did hold the ball very well, so it wasn't a problem. And England's press was so good that Ukraine never really got going. And then I guess once... one of the things with pressing, I think, that occasionally we don't quite appreciate is it's not just a physical tool. It's not just a tool of winning the ball back. It's a psychological tool. And this is something, when you talk to Argentinians who played against the first Bielsa sides, when pressing really first just lands in Argentina and people don't have a clue what's going on. And I remember talking to Juan Simon, you might remember the centre-back from the 1990 World Cup, played for Boca for a long time. And him saying, playing against Bielsa's Newell's, he said, you just didn't know, you'd never experienced that sense of just being suffocated. You couldn't do anything. There was never a moment of respite. You never had the ball. The ball was never at the other end of the pitch. You never had any time. And you know, if you go into a game physically fatigued and then you're facing that sort of, that blanket sort of crushing you. Can the blanket crush you? But then I can see how physical fatigue plus the mental pressure just leads you to go, oh, go on, and we're not going to mark you from corners. Just score, fine.
And actually on that note, Mason Mount is key in that, isn't he? Like, just in that...
That challenge he made in the first half, Ukraine got down the left, the ball was cut back, and it was two Ukrainians, and it's sort of... I mean, the first thought was, hopefully they'll get in each other's way. But no, somehow Mason Mount got in both of their ways. It was just sort of incredible. I mean, the burst of pace was incredible, but to have the awareness to be setting off as the ball was cut back. And I think, you see why everybody goes on about his intelligence as a player, his alertness to that danger, and then his ability to get back and time the challenge, is superb.
We should talk about Harry Kane, Flo. He played really quite well, and not just the goals. I thought the first one he took really well, actually, because it was quite a difficult finish. But that left foot volley that was saved was a moment of sort of, oh, this is Kane when he's fully confident and fully on it.
Yeah, and again, I'm not someone who has always kind of been Kane's biggest fan. Like, I really like Harry Kane, but I'm not someone who's felt like they have to stand up for him. But throughout this tournament, I feel like I have been in the minority where I felt like, Kane has actually been doing something. There's been kind of method in the madness. Yes, he hasn't been scoring goals up until Tuesday, but he's been having an influence, and it felt like it was all going to come good. And obviously tonight was his night. And with a player like him, he only needs, you know, a couple of opportunities and they will drop. And I thought, like you said, that first finish where he's falling down, he's off balance and he's still got quite a lot to do was just kind of typical Harry Kane, really. And then once he's got that, his confidence lifts so much. And then you feel like now everything is going to drop for him. He wants everything. He wants to have a go at everything. And I just thought he was fantastic tonight. And it's all just coming together at the right time.
Of the players left in the competition, he's kind of in pole position to win the Golden Boot, which is not something we'd have thought of after the first three group games.
So the question now, Barry, the question now is, which denomination of banknote should we put his face on?
The 2p.
And I think after the first game, or maybe it was the Scotland game, I said he looked like he was pulling a caravan. He didn't look fit and he should be dropped. And that is true. He did look like he was pulling a caravan. He didn't look fit and he did look like he should be dropped. Now, am I an idiot for saying that because he's now come good, or I don't know.
I'm worried because the nearer you get to the prize, the sort of, not the worst the failure, right? If England had lost tonight, that would have been a disaster, but the more painful the failure, right? You know, if you lose to the Ukraine... And...
No, but I don't see that, because for me, like ever since kind of a week ago, I've known that the hardest team we'll probably play is going to be in the final. So for me, I felt like with everything that's gone on as well, you know, over the last 50 years, actually getting to the final is a huge achievement. And then once you're in the final, anything can happen. So actually to get to the final for me is the biggest challenge. And then once you're in the final, you know, that's a whole different story. But actually getting there is the biggest challenge for me. And if we can do that, then I'm kind of already really happy.
I would much prefer you to lose the final to get drummed out in the group stage.
You see, I'm too scared of even mentioning the final. Right? The whole thing is just too, and I don't know how I'm meant to be or act. And then I'm thinking, if England are in the final, you know, I'm basically sit at home watching it on telly, my wife upstairs watching Alison Roman cooking tutorials on YouTube because I'm doing the pod, and thinking, is that where I want to be? Is this, my whole life has led to, well, it's not, I mean, other things have happened in my life, but like my England supporting moment has led to this.
In my head, the realistic thing would be getting to the final and getting absolutely smashed by France. Now France are out, it's getting to the final and having a kind of real tussle with Italy. And, you know, in 2018, we probably should have got to the final and got smashed by France. So this is kind of almost a repeat of that. But getting to the final in itself would be an amazing thing. And I think people need to kind of relish in that and then think like, oh, and then we could maybe win it as well.
You're right, Flo, but how many finals are you going to get to? I mean, we're not even in this one. Like, how many times do you have that chance to lift that trophy? Oh, the whole thing stresses me out tremendously.
Jonathan, has a team ever won a major finals without conceding a goal? Do you know?
Oh, Cote d'Ivoire, 1992. Come on, bring it on. Cote d'Ivoire, 1992.
Okay.
Because great story about that is the Cote d'Ivoire goalkeeper, Alain Guamini, had an elephant's tooth that he kept in his sock, which he believed made him as big as an elephant. So he was unbeatable. Although he was beaten in penalty shootouts, but not in open play.
How big is an elephant's tooth?
Big
enough. As big as a man's calf. It's 8 yards by 8 feet.
I painted an elephant once and got in a lot of trouble for it.
You did. It was sustainable paint.
I did see its teeth. But, yeah. I'd imagine if an elephant was standing in a goal, both top corners would still be accessible.
And I'm thinking just pop it between his legs.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
Cote d'Ivoire, of course, had nicknamed the elephants. So, like, it wasn't just, yeah, it wasn't just the size. It wasn't a, you know, an emotional attachment there.
I wonder if the other podcast reviews of the England game spend this much time on the Ivory Coast. Hugh says, would Jose still not pick Luke Shaw? Richard Jolly stat, Luke Shaw's got as many assists in his last two games with Gareth Southgate as he got in 2.5 years for Jose. He's been brilliant, Baz, hasn't he?
Outstanding. I'm really delighted for him because the manner in which Jose Mourinho bullied him when he was at Manchester United was, I thought, despicable. Jose continues to slag him off at every available opportunity, which suggests Luke Shaw occupies a special rent-free space in his head for whatever reason. And he's Gareth Southgate's first choice at left back, and he's simply outstanding.
Jordan Henderson's first senior goal for England on his 62nd cap, the longest ever wait by a player before scoring their first goal for England. Sol Campbell was the previous record holder, scoring his first after 47 games. It was a wonderful, just the sheer joy, Jordan Henderson. Think what he's achieved in his career. He was just so utterly delighted that he scored that goal. The Tin Booney says, did the pod ever reflect on the fact that none of this would have happened if that hotel hadn't agreed to sell wine in a pint glass? It's funny that, isn't it? To think... I mean, I don't know where we...
I'm sorry, but as a Sunderland fan, that was not funny. That moment ruined the club.
Paul says, how is it fair after so many years of hurt for me that my kids now just fully expect England to be getting to the semi-finals of major tournaments? I resent them for this. And Adam says, does Barry know what the Celtic Nation's contingency plan is if the unthinkable happens? Do we all stop pretending we've never heard of football? What would it mean to you, Barry?
It would... be in the top 10 worst moments of my life. And that is not an exaggeration.
Can you tell me what the other worst moments are, just so we can measure it up?
There's a smattering of bereavements. a couple of breakups. That incident on the train in Munich. And... England winning a major tournament.
I can't believe that England winning a major tournament is worse than, like, shitting your pants.
Oh, it is, absolutely.
Someone did say, where is that question? Would Barry rather 3 months of dysentery or England winning a major tournament?
Oh, God.
Would I definitely recover from the dysentery?
Yeah. You'll make a full recovery.
Think of the weight loss plan as well. You'd be talking about losing a bit of weight.
It was Rigoberto, Baz's choice. Dysentery for 3 months on the bounce, or it comes home.
Dysentery. I can't recover from England winning a major tournament. That is terminal. it can never unhappen. But if I can make a full recovery from... And this is football rivalry, but it's hugely important. And because the international team I support is so staggeringly mediocre, all I have is England failure to keep me going. Before we move on, I would just like to make the point that I'm sure there are listeners out there who... are bored with me.
Yes, they are.
Talking about how much I want the England football team. But I am only answering questions that you are asking me. So
yeah, no,
I haven't brought it up.
no, okay, that's acceptable. All right, in part two, we'll look back at Denmark's win over the Czech Republic. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. You've just got a day, or just over a day, to vote for us for Listener's Choice Awards at the British Podcast Awards. Go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, type in Guardian Football Weekly, and then click vote. It's simple, Barry, isn't it? Anyone can do it.
Yep, I've done it many times. So if I can do it many times, so can everyone else.
Excellent news. Please vote for us. We'd like it. But I don't want to. I don't want to sound desperate, though. I think that
ship has sailed, Max.
I've scheduled 24 hours of tweets starting at midnight, so I will lose many followers.
I mean, does it really count as listener's choice if you've basically badgered them into voting? And it's not really their choice at all. They're just doing it so you'll stop.
I did like the person yesterday who said, I was going to vote for you until Simon Burnton was so grumpy about Italy that I voted for someone else. I enjoyed that one. Anyway, let's do the Czech Republic 1, Denmark 2. Full disclosure, we are recording this before the England game, so I'm not giddily happy or depressed at the moment. But that is the truth. So I don't know. I've got this horrible feeling that we haven't won. I'm really sad about it. The game hasn't happened yet. So I should perhaps just relax.
And Barry's smiling with glee. So that's
exactly,
how you know.
Yeah. You look so smug about England's defeat, Barry.
You look so smug.
Even the thought of it makes Barry so excited.
I just can't believe we didn't match up shape for shape against our wing-backs.
Oh, and Sancho had a nightmare, didn't he? Anyway.
And I told you Pickford was going to mess up.
Oh, let's not.
Please,
let's not.
Please.
Because, come on. I don't want to do any manifesting.
I wasn't expecting, like, twice.
Oh, this won't be funny if it comes true.
No, it will not.
Jack says, now that Denmark looked good, is Barry proud of how the Irish only lost by the odd goal to them 9,000 times? The Bardi says, was I just too nervous to focus before the England game? Or was this actually quite a boring match? What sort of game was this, Wilson? It felt like it was played in slow motion to me.
That first half was sort of a lot of probing. And the fact both teams were similar shape, they seemed to sort of cancel each other out, except every now and again the Danish wing-backs got a bit of space. And that was what led to the second goal. Obviously, the first goal was some pretty poor defending from a corner. And at 2-0, you sort of thought Denmark were comfortable. And then the Czechs changed shape at half-time, made two substitutions, went to 4-4-2. And that first sort of 15, 20 minutes of the second half, they got the goal. They looked like they could come back into it. And then Kasper Juhlmann made a couple of changes, brought on Poulsen, who I thought did very well holding the ball up, and it all sort of calmed down again. And the Czechs, they sort of suddenly, that last 20 minutes, so I don't know if they were tired, but they just looked very limited, just pumping balls in the box, and Kerr and Christensen were quite happily heading it out.
The moment of the game flow was that cross from Joachim Mähler, wasn't it? It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, unbelievable how he does that with the outside of his foot. I mean, just ridiculous. And we found it quite funny watching it because Braithwaite again going for the header, like yet again the millionth chance that he can't make do. But luckily, was it Olberg, wasn't it, who was there to kind of react? And it was a really good finish as well. But yeah, unbelievable ball.
Yeah, I thought Dahlberg didn't look that. That was a weird thing. When he scored that second, he didn't really look that bothered. He didn't look like, this is basically got us through to the semi-final of the European Championships, Baz. I mean, maybe, like I say, he's one of the twins from Minority Report. He's not actually he's a cyborg. And that only served to echo what I've thought already. But I find it strange when players don't go sort of deliriously happy when they score a goal of such significance.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think it was a boring game, but it was a very strange and surreal game. And I think quite a lot of that is probably down to the fact that both teams were dragged to Baku to play it. There was only 10,000 fans in a, I think, 70 or 80,000 seater stadium. There was less than 2,000 Danish and Czech Republic fans combined at the game. It was very hot. They're both clearly very tired. And I think a combination of all those factors made for quite a weird game. I was absorbed by it. And I said during the minute-by-minute that it struck me as being sort of more like an end-of-season Premier League game between two mid-table sides who weren't that bothered about the result. And when you consider what's at stake, a semi-final against Ukraine, who are eminently beatable, you would have thought they'd have been able to rise themselves for it. But, yeah, neither of them seemed that fussed. And even going into the last 10 minutes, Czech Republic, they were dropping bombs into the Denmark box, but there was no real urgency, I thought. It's not a criticism of the players particularly. They're clearly dog-tired, but it's very much a criticism of UEFA for having the game in Baku in the first place, which is absolutely ludicrous. You need a visa to go there. That costs money. You need COVID tests, which costs money. Flights are expensive, whatever roundabout way you go there. And once again, it's UEFA showing contempt for the fans. I mean, there was no guarantee it was going to be the Czechs and Denmark there, but whoever was going to be in that playing there would have struggled to get fans out there.
The stories as well that local security confiscated a rainbow flag from some Danish fans.
Yeah, I saw those pictures as well. It's pretty depressing. The sort of inconsistency of that message and when it's allowed and when it isn't has been an absolute mess throughout this tournament. We should say that UEFA have put a statement regarding this latest incident saying they, quote, never instructed stewards in Baku or in any other stadium to confiscate rainbow flags. They say they're currently investigating what happened and will contact local authorities to clear this up. You mentioned the players being dog-tired, Barry. I had quite a busy morning. I'm obviously getting over my second jab and I'm quite soft. And I sat down with a glass of water and then I woke up and Denmark were 1-0 up after 15 minutes. So what I missed, that it wasn't a corner for that. There's an interesting question from Jerry saying, look, if they VAR check loads of passes before a goal, should they check events leading to a set piece? Does anyone? I mean, that would great.
No, of course not.
Okay, good.
Of course they shouldn't, Okay. Because I how many corners are there in the average game? 10.
It would take forever, but I wouldn't put it past them to start doing that.
But it's just how far back do you go? I mean, you know, what if there's a corner that's correctly given, but that came from a throw-in that was incorrectly given? Do we then start checking that? Then what if that throw-in was correct, but the goal kick that led to that wasn't? I mean, should just replay the entire game. Yeah, it's an 89th-minute winner, but sorry, lads. We've got to go through 89 minutes of video first. Look, Aggie, there's a mistake in the second minute, so we're going to have to go back, play the last 87 minutes again. Once there's a set play, there's a new phase of play. And that goal didn't happen because the corner was wrongly given. It happened because of Kerr making the blocking run and then terrible marking and a good delivery.
Well, it wasn't my question. I was only passing on.
Yeah, you've got to filter them. It's on you. Come on.
How good are the Danes, Barry?
It's a good question. I don't know is the answer. I wasn't hugely impressed with them in this game, but they have impressed me throughout the tournament on a number of levels for the way they coped with the near tragedy in their opening game to how they bounced back from that. Their win over Wales was very impressive, but Wales weren't great in that game, to say the least. So, look, as you said, we don't know who they'll be playing in the semi-final yet, but I wouldn't be scared of them. But they are a capable team, and they do seem to have a lot of momentum, and There's a bit of fairy dust sprinkled around them, I think, and that might count for nothing and might count for something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a danger with that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the sort of the fairy tale aspect lends their run this sort of sense of destiny, which I think does help players. I think, you know, if they, whatever their actual metaphysical beliefs, you have days or weeks or months when you sort of feel that it's right for you. And they clearly have that. So that's not a factor. But I think there is a danger that if you focus on that too much, you can overlook what a good team they are. And I wonder if what's going on, you see it every now and again, that if you have a coach who's sort of, you know, either a real sort of stern, hard taskmaster or whose tactics are very sort of stifling and defensive, as they had under Olga Feider, and then you replace him with somebody who's much more charismatic, much more open. I think what can, and you can even say when Leicester won the league, there's an element of this, that the structures are put in place and then they're allowed to blossom by the second man coming in. Or, you know, the England cricket team, when Michael Vaughan replaced Nasser Hussain. Nasser Hussain got the fundamentals right, laid the foundations, but actually there's then a finishing off process of letting the thing blossom. And I wonder if that's what's happening with Ullman, who clearly is a... He's very good at man management. He's very good at sort of maintaining the emotional level of players.
Flo?
Yeah, I think what they do have, which is important for tournament football, is they've really grown into the tournament. They've looked better with every game, I think. I think before what happened to Eriksen in that Finland game, they looked very stodgy. And I think they still have that stodginess to them, but they look far more threatening going forward now than they did in any of their group games, really, even though they had that win against Russia. They didn't even still look that convincing. So I think they do look much more dangerous going forward now. And I think if it's going to be England facing them, then probably in the last few games you would say, Denmark might be a bit of a threat. Whereas if you watch on the group stages, you'd think absolutely not.
Another Jerry said, And it almost feels like a sort of sacrilegious question to say, look, are Denmark better without Eriksen? Which seems mad because he, for so long he was such a like pivotal member of that team. And it does seem that they've managed to replace him quite well. But I mean, I don't know. Once again, I'm just passing on the message, Wilson. Maybe I should have filtered that one too.
No, I think there might be something in that. I mean, they've changed shape. They've gone to the back three. It's got Damsgaard into the side, and I think he gives them something a bit extra, something a bit different. I think to say they're better without him, I think that's a bit oversimplistic. But I think what has happened is his absence has it's focused minds and sort of maybe relieve some of the pressure players were feeling that there's been a sort of resetting of perspectives. But also, I think it did encourage a change of shape. And Damsgaard clearly gives them a bit more. And the two wing backs, Sviggo Larsson and Mailer, I think have both been excellent. I mean, Mailer had been really good up till this game, and then Sviggo Larsson, I thought, was excellent today. I don't want to say they're better without him, but certainly his absence has allowed other things to happen, which may not have happened had he been there.
What I did notice, actually, by the end of the game, the Czechs had two players, Jan Boril and Thomas Suchek, Terry butchered up with white bloodstained bandages. I thought that would be enough to see them through, but no, it wasn't. And interestingly, I saw a friend of mine in Ireland make the comparison that we debated the other night about the Swede Danielsson getting sent off for what was basically an accidental collision with Bezedin, the Ukrainian, who more or less ran into his outstretched leg. But Suchek sustained his injury in an accidental collision with Yusuf Poulsen's studs, and he cut his head and had to get bandaged up. You would think, going, you know, if there was consistency, Poulsen should also have been sent off, but he wasn't.
Yeah, I saw people saying that, and no part of me thinks he should have been, but I completely understand the point that you're making.
It's just a minor side point, really. It's not that important.
No, that's okay. I mean, we got lots of questions, more questions on the bandages than anything else from this game. The Podfather, is this the most head bandage-ridden tournament in history? With 8 minutes to go, says Thomas, the Czechs leading 2-0 in the head bandage department. If the score stays 2-1, would this be the first time in the history of the Euros where a team loses despite having such a massive bandage advantage? And the chocolate sommelier says, was two guys with bandage heads lumping it long to Matija Vidra even too much for Sean Dyche? which I quite liked. And Colin said, I've noticed injured players seem to be attended by physios dressed in suits. Obviously, the Italian physio was immaculately turned out, but the Czech one today was in his Sunday best. Are we in an era of, is he a tracksuit physio or more of a shirt and tie approach? It's something to look out for the last three games of the tournament, I suppose. Oh, these tournaments end quickly, don't they? I sort of feel like there were so many and now there's so few games. Life is ephemeral. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the semi-finals and do any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So we know now, we didn't know in part two, we did in part one, but we know now that the semi-finals are Denmark, England and Spain, Italy. Ryan says, should we be dreading the fact this game is on ITV, not the BBC? Yeah, the record is terrible.
But I thought even that Udo is broken, is it not?
No, I don't think so, because this was on the BBC. The Germany game was on the BBC.
Okay.
Czech Republic game, was that on ITV?
Yeah, but that's not... I know knockout games are the... Anyway. Should we speculate on what Southgate might do personnel-wise? Wilson, what would you do? What do you think he'll do?
Well, I think there's a very good argument to going back to the back three. If you think how good the two Denmark wingbacks were today, Mailer in particular throughout the tournament, I think it's been excellent. So, but it's not there's a right or wrong answer there, is it? You can do what you did against Germany, and you can match them shape for shape, and sort of try and negate them, or you can do what Saka did tonight and put wingers high up behind the wingbacks and say, okay,
what you're going to do. Are you going to let our wingers just stand there, or are you going to drop back to mark them? Your decision on which you do depends on to the extent to which you can control. Do you think you can control the centre midfield? And I, you know, against Germany, Southgate obviously was concerned about that. Against Ukraine, he didn't have a worry about that, and you know, he was right, I think, on both occasions. Yeah, that Danish midfield is obviously better than the Ukrainian midfield. So I don't know. I don't know.
Do you think? I wonder if he's more likely to stick with the four because Mason Mount is available. Who is that sort of?
That team? Yeah, I mean that is a point. Yeah, that is a good point. One of the really encouraging things I think about Southgate, just generally, not just in this tournament, but has been his willingness to leave players out. Yeah, there's no sense of a core group who, you know, will never be dropped. I mean, realistically, probably are three or four who will never be dropped if they're fit. But it's not like Svenja Eriksson, where you knew 9 of 11 players, whoever you were playing, however fit they were, you knew those 9 would play. Well, Southgate has been very good at horses for courses management. You know, England's research into opponents has been exemplary so far. I think they spend a lot of time on that, and I think, yeah, we're seeing the benefits of that.
Flo, you look like you've fallen asleep. I mean, I thought that was one of Wilson's more interesting
answers.
No,
I just... Wilson was sitting back in his chair, so I thought I would sit back in this chair, but it's quite a big chair, so I kind of looked like I was in the Big Brother diary room.
Sort of looked like Father... Yeah, a mixture between that and Father Jack. And I'll let you you know, in on something. If I thought one person was going to be looking like Father Jack by the end of this podcast, it wasn't you.
No, I kind of agree. I do think we'll probably see more of the Germany team, but trying to work out where to put Mason Mount. I still think Grealish, Sancho and Rashford are, you know, fine to come off the bench and more impactful that way. I think it makes sense to move back towards the team that played against Germany, but try and bring Mason Mount, try and fit him in somehow.
Barca GM, our mate, says, are the Danes good enough to prevent the unpleasantness? What do you reckon, Baz?
I think on their day, yes, they are good enough. As someone who's watched them play against the Republic of Ireland, you know, once a week for the last 4 years, I'm pretty familiar with them. I would be very surprised if they beat England, but I can't remember a team, and this may be our old friend recency bias sticking his head above the parapet. I can't remember a team having as serene a progress through a tournament in quite some time as England are having this one. And something in me tells me they're due a stink or a bad game or just an error-ridden game, or you know, letting in some calamitous defensive error that will cause them problems. And I'd almost like to see how they would deal with a serious setback. I would also like to see England play Italy or Spain, ideally Italy, because I bet on Italy before the tournament started. But I think I'd prefer an England-Italy-Spain final than an England-Denmark final. I think Denmark could pose England problems. I could also see them getting beaten 4-0. England are a really good side.
Did that hurt?
Yeah.
Spain-Italy then. Wilson, how do you see this?
Italy have played better through the tournament. There's no question about that. Yeah, I was in Munich last night and I thought they were really good in both halves for different reasons. I thought first half they attacked very well, second half they defended very well in their own idiosyncratic way, which doesn't seem universally popular, but they did it very well. What do you call those things? The, you know, the weather house things? The man comes out when it's raining, and then the woman comes out when it's sunny.
Yeah, I know.
I think Spain and Italy are a bit like that. I don't think that they're ever both outside at the same time. The Spanish football had this hang-up about Italy for a long time. They play the pretty football, and they'd always run into Italy, and Italy's cynicism would undo them. And that's why that victory in the quarterfinal of the year 2008 on penalties was so significant for Spain. And Spain obviously had the upper hand since, and they beat them in the final in 2012.
I was actually about to tell you what a weather house was. It's a folk art device in the shape of a small German or Alpine chalet that indicates the weather. A typical weather house has two doors side by side. The left side has a girl or a woman, the right a boy or a man. The female figure comes out of the house when the weather is sunny and dry. The man often carrying an umbrella, comes out to indicate rain. So there you are.
So anyway, yeah, but I don't know which one's sun and which one's rain, but the Spanish one has been out and maybe is on its way back in. And the semi-final will be the moment when the weather breaks.
We end on a very important point. Keith got in touch about neighbours that we were discussing yesterday. I think Libby Kennedy, says Keith, was the neighbour's character you were reaching for, Max. Michelle Banas replaced Kim Valentine for a few weeks when Kim was ill. Nikki Bandini is also correct on Cheryl Stark. Caroline Glimmer was briefly replaced by Colette Mann. Confusingly, Colette returned to play Sheila Canning a few years later. Lou Carpenter was in relationships with both Cheryl and Sheila. He must have been very confused. Anyway.
There was also Beverly, Philip Martin's wife.
Yes.
Who went away to a conference or something.
Yeah.
And came back played by a different actress with a totally different personality. She was really nice when she went away, came back really hard-faced and difficult.
That'll do for today.
We seem to have gone slightly off topic.
Yeah, I know. That's okay. Right. Thank you so much for your time, Flo.
Cheers, Max.
Barry, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Max.
And Jonathan Wilson, and should say that you're doing your first pod in your new house, which is much more echoey than your previous bookshelf-laden house, just in case people were wondering what had happened. I don't know how echoey it sounds. I just thought I'd reference it, much like Ewan's jazz. So
it sounds echoey from here, definitely. I will work out a better solution when I've been here for more than 24 hours.
Thank you so much. And we'll be back for the semi-finals.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.